having anything to bring before the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the honorable court.
Good morning, counsel. You ready to proceed?
Okay. Morning. Since 1978, when Judge Stapleton decided the O'Hanlon case, which was then followed in 1984 by Judge Taylor in the Morris case, the courts of this state, Supreme Court included, have said that 3902 is a statute that requires insurance companies to inform their insureds how to protect themselves from the term, I guess, is impecunious. It's really financially irresponsible tortfeasors. The O'Hanlon case started it in 78, as I said, and all the way, I think the most recent case from this court is 2004 in the Datura case, where the courts, and especially this court, have said that the purpose of 3902 is a disclosure mechanism that requires insurance companies to inform their insurers, like Mr. Sammarco in this case, that they could protect themselves from the irresponsible driver by buying uninsured or underinsured coverage, which is really the same coverage depending upon the circumstances, an amount to protect themselves. In this case, we are asking this court to reverse what it did in 1998 in the NAF case by allowing Mr. Sammarco, in this case, to have his UM coverage equal as liability coverage. I recognize that the statute that the NAF case referred to is really the central point of our discussion today, I think, anyway. And that is, doesn't this statute, as Judge Abelman said in the Sammarco case in the Superior Court, isn't it clear on its face? Doesn't that compel the decision that I'm making? Doesn't the statute compel this conclusion? And I said, first of all, to Judge Abelman, well, you have to follow NAF, that's clear. I'd like an opportunity to address the same question with the Supreme Court, which is where we are today, of course. But the second is that statute ambiguous? And certainly this court over the years has found 3902 to be ambiguous in a number of cases, not specifically dealing with the clause that we're dealing with here today. And that clause says that you can't buy, I argue anyway, and there's two interpretations of 3902 that I think are valid, and the one that we think the court should follow is that 3902B says that you cannot buy uninsured motorist coverage which is greater than your liability coverage.
Well, help me understand where A12 fits in this. On your appendix, you attached an offer of insurance.
I have that, Your Honor, if I can get that.
So is A12 something that your client has, or something that they should have given your client but did not give to your client?
Well, I don't know that there's any evidence that Mr. Sammarco did not receive this document, Your Honor. In the Mason case, you may remember that the court had before it the question of whether there was an informed, whether the insured was provided information adequate to make the decision, and the court said you cannot put a document at page 41 of 50 pieces of paper and expect him to understand what he has. A12 is thus set forth uninsured motorist coverage, the levels that are available, and the cost.
But how does this fit into the record of the present case for purposes of our decision? This is part of the record?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And what are you representing that its significance is?
Well, the significance is several. First, that USAA only sells split limits. It doesn't sell single limits. That the amounts are identified that USAA does sell 300, 500 in UM coverage, and if Mr. Sammarco had been informed in the sense of true information, he could have purchased that for a nominal figure of $51 per vehicle.
So I see that at the top of the page, and the reason I ask the question is because the way I understand your argument is that if this had been done correctly at the beginning, your client would have gotten a sheet of paper like this. He had an underlying policy, 300, 500.
Yes.
Could have purchased the same insurance here by checking the block, 300, 500 for uninsured.
Correct.
And if we assume all of those are the facts, what the insurance company's position is, according to you, is even if that's true, when we reform the contract as a matter of law based on the incorrect or lack of information, it should only be reformed up to what we would be mandated to do by statute, independent of what we were offering everyone else.
I believe that is exactly the issue, Your Honor. And the issue, okay, I'm not sure I answered your question properly, is there's no evidence that Mr. Sammarco received this, but even if he did, it was within a whole packet of papers that the Mason case says isn't a meaningful offer.
So your argument is, if we start with the predicate that we didn't get correct information, you can't simply reform the contract consistent with the statute. You have to reform the contract consistent with what they were offering if it exceeded the statute.
Consistent with what his liability covered.
Exactly.
Yes, that's correct.
He could buy mirror image coverage.
Exactly.
What is inconsistent with the statute of doing it the way you argue?
I don't think there's anything inconsistent, Your Honor, because if you look at that clause that says, but not to exceed the basic limits, that sets forth that you can buy up to your liability coverage, but not beyond.
Is it a fair reading of the statute that the General Assembly has said that no company is obligated to offer more than 100, 300 to an insured who bought BI at 100, 300?
I think
that's... But if the company wishes to offer more than that, an insured can buy an equal amount of UM/UIM to what they provide to the public in BI coverage.
That's the argument we're making, exactly.
And that, how is that in any way inconsistent with the way the statute reads?
I don't think it's inconsistent at all.
Well, how do you reconcile that reading of the statute with the language up to a limit of $100,000, $300,000?
Your Honor, I think the only way to answer that is that, as I think, and let me get the quote of Justice Berger in, I think it was the... It might have been the Dessula case... Colonial versus Ayers, and I hope I have this correct. The answer to that question cannot be gleaned from the plain meaning of the language itself, which is why there are rules of statutory construction. The primary rule is that statute should be interpreted to give effect to the intent of the legislature.
So we don't have to ignore the plain meaning of the statute in order to give effect to what you argue is the intent of the legislature?
I don't think you ignore the plain meaning of the statute at all, Your Honor, because I don't think the statute's clear. I mean, the argument that it's ambiguous is one that I make as an officer of the court, that I don't know what it means. I know what I think it means, but it could mean exactly what I'm arguing, that you can't get more than your underlying coverage in UM. It says 100, 3, or 300, comma, but not to exceed the basic limits.
But hasn't it always been interpreted as a cap in other cases?
I think that's fair.
And particularly... didn't Judge Stapleton in one of his opinions talk about how the General Assembly picked that 100, 300 because that was a good number at the time? Perhaps it should be raised, but isn't that, was that language in his opinion?
Yes, it was. I think he was saying that $300,000 was the number that I remember Judge Stapleton referring to being what was considered to be a very inadequate amount, actually sort of the Cadillac amount of insurance back in 1978. And he did say he understood that's why the legislature picked that number. And it may be that the General Assembly should revisit that issue and make the statute more clear, first of all, and maybe put a different number in there.
Well, why shouldn't we interpret the statute to be saying any more than to insurance carriers, you shall offer 100, 300. So anyone who buys BI at 100, 300 will have the option of 100, 300 UM, UIM. That's what you shall do. There are cases that suggest that parties should be able to contract for more than that. If you're willing to put your liability on the roadway, as a result of your negligence, you've injured someone, and you provide them with 300, 500, why should you not, and why does this statute preclude one, from being able to purchase UM, UIM at that same level if the company's willing to offer it at a certain price and you're willing to buy it? How is that in any way inconsistent with the statute?
Your Honor, that's the whole point of our case. That's why again, in the Kulis case, Judge Babiarz had performed the issue of a single limit 300 policy. That's not what this case is about. This case, and if you remember the Mason case, that was a 103 policy, and it was reformed to 103 by this court, saying that there wasn't a meaningful offer. If and I'm getting to agreeing to your observation that because Mr. Sammarco went out and bought a higher policy, in fact, his daughter has a 300, 500 policy in Virginia because apparently Virginia mandates that you do that. Mr. Sammarco wasn't aware that his daughter
had a policy. Is there any case where we've ever said you only have to comply with the statute if you were offering everyone else more?
No, I have not seen any case that says that.
So to the extent the other cases have talked about the statutory limit, that was the only issue in the case, that there wasn't any question that more was being offered.
Your Honor, I don't recall reading cases that spoke to statutory limits. They spoke to the limits of the amount of coverage that the person had and the effort to reform the UMUIM to that level. I don't remember any case other than that saying this is why you're limited to 103 because the statute says that.
Yeah, speaking of that, if we were to adopt your view in this case, would we have to reverse that, or is there a way of distinguishing it that could be characterized as other than disingenuous?
I think it has to be reversed. That was an order of this court. It was not an argument, but it's a decision of this court. And I think the court has to say, as it has on other occasions, we revisited the issue. We now have an en banc determination that the Knapp analysis was incorrect. In the Knapp case, there is a parenthetical observation that you refer to 103 or such lesser amounts as are contained in the basic policy. That's what it says in that. That's not the statute. The statute reads otherwise, but not to exceed the basic limits. I think, Your Honor, to answer your question, if you decide that Sammarco should be reversed, then in effect reverses that.
Is there assume the statute didn't exist, and on the factual scenario of the actual negotiations and the purchase between your client and the insurer, in terms of that factual scenario, would there be a basis for an equitable reformation to bring this policy in line with the liability coverage, apart from the Superior Court? My recollection is the Superior Court deals with reformation because it's a matter of enforcing the statute. Otherwise, you'd be in the Court of Chancery.
Well, interestingly, these cases originated in Chancery, and Justice Hartnett wrote the first opinion in Schwartz even before or right after Stapleton's first opinion, but that's where we brought these cases early on. And either because Chancery didn't want to have them or they thought they were contract actions that belonged in the Superior Court, that's where they were filed thereafter. Could there be an equitable reformation? I believe not. I think it would have to be.
Well, what makes this case different from that and the other cases, at least the way I read the facts, is we have a situation where the carrier was offering more than 100, 300. They've now discovered they didn't inform your client of the options properly. And they say, well, under the statute, we only have to offer you 100, 300. But that's in the context of, at the time, we were offering everyone else more. So the question is, can the carrier say, I only have to offer 100, 300 by statute, and it's irrelevant that I was offering everybody else more at the time I didn't inform you?
That's what they're doing here. As a matter of fact, Mr. Sammarco now has 300, 500. Because he understood that he had that available to him.
But isn't that what we would be defining, is that you didn't inform the person properly, so we need reformation, and the carrier saying, I only had to offer them under the statute 100, 300, therefore notwithstanding the fact I didn't inform this person correctly, and I was offering everyone else more, 100, 300 is all we have to offer.
That's exactly where we are, and that's exactly the position we're arguing is improper, that because this court has taken the position that the law or 3902 requires insurance companies to allow individuals to protect themselves to the extent they protect others, he should have 300, 500.
And you don't think that's inequitable?
Inequitable?
Right.
I do not. Do I think it's inequitable that the carrier should now...
The position they're taking, you don't think that's...
Oh, I think... I'm sorry, maybe I misheard you, Your Honor. I think that's quite inequitable.
Well, that's why I'm asking. Is there a remedy in equity?
I haven't thought that through. I'm sorry. I think the way the cases work, we'd have to follow what we did in Superior Court.
All right.
And if there is an equitable remedy, I'm not sure. It, it relates back. The courts here have said, including in the Arms case, that the option to purchase continues and it relates back to the event if they didn't make the right offer, which is where we are today.
The record does show that there's no dispute that at the time this policy was entered into, USAA was offering more than 100-300 UIM coverage.
That was available generally.
It was available.
Yes. And USAA has conceded that they did not make an informed offer to Mr. Samarco before the accident.
Well, there seems to be a suggestion in Mr. Casarino's brief that that's acknowledged for purposes of the procedural posture, but maybe not for all purposes. Did you read that?
I certainly did. I'm not sure what that meant. It was a motion for judgment on the pleadings, brought based upon that, and that's where we are.
Well, it suggested if we reversed the Superior Court and it went back to Superior Court, and the Superior Court realized that reformation should be to the level of 300, 500, and not 100, 300, that USAA would still be able to have a trial on whether they, in fact, made the offer or not. That's what it suggests to me.
I think Mr. Gasserina might have to answer, but I think that's probably true, although they may determine that the reversal is effective and just perform the policy.
I took it USAA was being a generous and benevolent citizen and helping us straighten out the law, but still have a chance to avoid liability when it went back to trial.
You know, so long as you can hang on to your money, you ought to try, I guess. All right, thank you.
May it please the court. One of the questions asked to Mr. Van Ogtrop was whether there have been any other decisions where you have issues similar to this. Actually, there was. In the Kenner case, which is an en banc decision by the court, which we all talk about, one of the arguments made by Kenner was that he should be able to reform his policy to more than 100, 300, but up to 300, 500. And now, that's not correct. At that time, the Kenner case, I believe that the statute required 300,000. Doesn't require that anymore. Now it's 100, 300. He wanted to reform it, not just to 300,000, but to 300, 500. And I'll just quote what the court said. However, there is no basis in the statute or in the decisions of this court for deeming Aetna to have offered coverage that exceeds, and you underscore exceeds, the requirements of Section 3902B. Or that creates an illogical distinction between underinsured motorists and uninsured or fully insured motorists. The statute was enacted, and it goes on to say the purpose of it.
Well, I asked a question earlier, had to make sure that the offer had been made at the higher limits in this case, because I don't read what you just quoted or any of our prior cases of having facts before us where there was an offer at the higher level. And do you agree that there was an offer at the 300, 500 level in this case? I mean, it wasn't to the extent of...
The claim was that we did not make the offer. And we're saying, okay, we did not fully comply with Mason. Mason was the case similar to this where USAA did it by, as it does all its policies, by sending out a packet of information. That packet of information, had it been read by the plaintiff, indicates that he can receive UIM coverage and UM coverage up to the limits of his liability. If he wants it, it's an option he can purchase. There's no doubt about that. If he wants to buy it, he can. But that's not dealing with the statute. That's what USAA offers. Now, you indicated we did not concede, or did we concede that we owe this? We've conceded for purposes of the motion to dismiss that Mason would follow, and we owe 100, 300 in UM coverage. But interestingly, if there's a factual hearing on this, we have arguments to make that this man knew he could get 300, 500 because he received the packet of information. He received it every 6 months. That's all.
Well, that's the point I was trying to follow. If you concede that we didn't inform the person correctly, then, as I understand your argument, it is based on that concession, we only now have to offer 100, 300, even though at the time we were offering everyone 300, 500 if it would have matched their policy. So help us understand if we assume that the offer wasn't made clearly and there has to be reformation, why the reformation should be limited to 100, 300 in the statute if everyone else could have gotten 300, 500 to track their basic policy?
Well, basically because that's what the statute requires. We're now dealing with a situation where there's been an accident. The man didn't pay for this additional insurance. And the courts have said, well, you're now entitled to reform your policy after the accident to get that coverage. Now, that's the reason, because the statute compels the insurance company to now provide insurance coverage post-accident, so to speak. And that policy, or that statute has a limit on it, has a cap.
I don't understand that. Doesn't the statute say to the insurance carrier, even before the policy is written, that you must, you shall, I think is the word, offer to the insured an option to match their BI coverage at least up to the level of 100, 300 if they purchased 100, 300. And then the balance of the statute suggests that the parties may contract for more than that up to the level of the BI coverage purchase as they choose. And in your situation, USAA affirmatively offers its insureds every 6 months the option of matching their BI with the same amount of UIM coverage. What is the significance of your view that the statute only applies after an accident?
First off, I disagree with your interpretation of the statute. It doesn't say that you must offer UM the same amount of liability. If the statute had said that, we wouldn't be here.
No, it says you shall offer 100, 300. That is like the threshold.
I hate to disagree, and I think this is the distinction I'm trying to make. The option is to purchase additional coverage up to a limit of 100, 300, or 300,000, but not to exceed your basic limits. That's what the statute is saying. Not that you have to offer 100, 300. You have to offer up to 100, 300, but not to exceed your basic limits.
What is the public policy behind limiting insurers and insurers who will affirmatively offer it anyway? The option to buy UIM that matches their BI coverage. What sound public policy of any kind would be behind that?
Public policy behind the insurance company offering it? I'm not sure I understand your question.
Behind the legislature saying that we as a regulatory body will say to both insurers and insurance companies, you cannot buy more than 100, 300 in UIM, even if your BI coverage you just purchased is in excess of that. What would be the sound public policy?
Well, there isn't any. I don't think that's what the statute is requiring at all. They're just simply, what the legislature is simply saying is, by statute, we are mandating that you have to offer up to 100, 300. You can sell whatever you want. I don't think that the legislature is making any distinction. But if you're going to mandate that UM be the same as liability, say it. And that's all the legislature had to do. They could simply have said, you have to offer an insurance company UM for the same amount of liability, and that's the end of it. But the legislature didn't do that. You know, there is no common law right to have uninsured motorist coverage. That's a creation of the insurance industry. And as the court's aware, this statute, 3902, has gone through a lot of changes. Originally, the legislature simply required that the insurance companies offer an amount not less than what is required by the financial responsibility law. And then in the early 70s, they added 300,000. And we had some cases dealing, well, what does 300,000 mean? Does that mean split limits or single limits? And then in the mid-80s, the legislature changed it again to say, no, we now say that you have to offer 100, 300 split limits or 300,000 single limits.
Let's take it a step at a time to help me understand this. First, let's assume that there's some merit in giving, in the legislature's mind, in giving insureds the opportunity to purchase UIM coverage, and that the amount of BI that they purchase, the amount of liability insurance they make available to others and they may injure, they should have some opportunity to cover themselves when they're injured by someone who's underinsured or uninsured. And
and the legislature says, well, in balance, we want to encourage this. But we don't want to put insurance companies in a position where they have to underwrite at a higher level on an obligatory basis. It makes sense to us. So we write a statute that says, you shall, insurance carriers, provide at least a level of $300,000 in UM, UIM for those who purchase that amount of BI coverage. And below that, you can match it. But why do you have to read the statute after that to say that that's any more than a threshold? Why does it have to be a cap? Why doesn't the balance of the statute and the policy behind it suggest that any free contracting parties in the market can offer and accept at an agreeable premium coverage for UM, UIM that matches whatever level of BI they make? Why would the legislature want to prevent that from happening in the market? It doesn't achieve any socially sound purpose.
I'm not saying they are preventing it. They're not preventing it at all. No one is suggesting that an insurance company can't sell UIM coverage or UM coverage in the same amount as liability, $1 million if they want to.
So this statute does not prevent an equitable reformation of the contract with USAA?
I think that's true. And I know there's at least one case in Chancery where they're trying to reform it. But that's not the issue here. The question is, what can they reform it to?
Well,
maybe an issue.
Mr. Casarino, on that issue, let's, assuming hypothetically that this court were to reverse the trial court's decision and remand some sort of reformation proceeding, whether it be in equity or in law, I understood you in answer to an earlier question to say that USAA would have defenses, including the argument that Mr. Sammarco knew that he could have obtained this higher level, that is 300, 500 of UIM coverage. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
So I take that to mean that if Mr. Sammarco had requested that coverage, that is, that requested UIM coverage that tracked the bodily injury coverage that he did in fact purchase, USAA would have provided it for the appropriate premium.
I think that's probably true. If he had asked for it and there's evidence that he asked for it and we didn't give it to him, certainly he can reform his policy.
Okay. Doesn't your side's reading of the statute create an incentive for insurance companies not to make the offer of coverage higher than 100, 300 for UIM? Because by not doing that, and if an accident occurs where there would be a higher UIM payout than 100, 300, the only legal obligation they would have would be to provide 100, 300.
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's the case at all. I think insurance companies like to sell insurance, and they would encourage people to buy higher limits. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. That's why USAA offers these higher limits, because they encourage people to buy them. They say in there, we encourage you to get it up to your limits. But we can't force people to buy it. And if people do not, and they only want to carry 10,000 or 15,000, I'm sorry, in UIM, we can't force them to get a higher level.
Well, that's not an issue, is it? Nobody forced Mr. Sammarco to buy the higher level of insurance because he wasn't told.
Well, so he
that
says.
Is available.
So he says. So he says. Now, that of course, I don't think that's before the court. I think the issue that's here is, if we have to reform it, do we reform it more than required by the legislature? And why would the legislature put a cap in there of $300,000 if the court's going to say, no, you have to give them UM equal to liability?
Well, one answer might be the particular facts of this case require that as a matter of equity, because your client was offering a higher amount. If it had been offered, it would have been accepted, and it's just putting everybody where they would have been had things gone as they should.
That involves a hearing. That involves a hearing.
Well, let me make sure if I understand what we're doing in this case, because what it appears to be is that at this stage of the proceedings in the Superior Court, you took the position, all right, assume that we didn't give notice. We're willing to have it reformed consistent with the statute 100-300.
That's correct.
However, if that legal position is not correct, whether we want to have a trial on all issues, including the fact that we did give notice. So if this goes back, you're reserving the right to argue that you did give notice, aren't you?
If the court were to rule that we had to offer 300, 500, the answer is yes. We moved to dismiss because we said the maximum we have to pay is 100, 300 based upon the statute. We're willing to pay it. We're not going to have a hearing.
Our court wouldn't rule that way. What our court would rule hypothetically is if it's conceded that adequate opportunity to purchase 300, 500 was not given and it was being offered to everyone else, and then it has to be offered now as part of the reformation, you can't stop at the statutory limit. That would be the ruling of this court if it was made available. And my question to you is that something that you would go to trial on and argue that we did make it available, we didn't take it, and now it's too bad?
It's tough to answer that question at this point because there has been no hearing, and I really can't do that. As we said, we did not concede, except for purposes of this hearing, that USAA did not offer. The problem we have is that the court decided in Mason that this type of an offer was inadequate as a matter of law. And there have been other decisions by the courts where the similar things have come about, and the courts have said it's inadequate because Mason said it's inadequate. I'm not sure this case can be distinguished without going into discovery, so I can't really answer that. But it may. It may. But for purposes of this case, USAA has conceded, basically because of Mason, that we did not give a meaningful offer and that we have to reform the policy and that the maximum we reform it to is 100, 300 because that's what the statute says. The statute doesn't say that you have to reform it up to limits beyond 100, 300.
So the legal issue would be if someone didn't give the notice required by Mason and there has to be a reformation, is it limited to the statute, or if they were offering more, is the reformation possible to go above the statutory limits to the extent it mirrors what their basic coverage was?
I think that's correct. I think that's correct. That's what we're arguing. No matter what.
But didn't I hear you concede that the statute would not prevent an equitable reformation if there was a basis for it?
If there's a factual basis for equitable reformation, sure. I can understand that. But let's assume for a moment that Mr. Sammarco argued in a chance reaction and had evidence that he asked for this insurance, thought he had it, paid for it, or believed he paid for it, wasn't provided, then there may be a reformation action. But I don't think that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with here someone who never got that insurance, never asked for that additional insurance, is claiming that he was not informed that he could have gotten that insurance. And then now wants it, and wants it in the amount of $300, $500, because that's what he has in liability coverage.
I'm starting to have a problem of my own, apparently of my own, with respect to the posture this case is in, because I don't understand how you can concede that Mason notice was not given only if you get the result you want, which is to have the trial court's decision affirmed, but you're not willing to concede it if the legal issue of the meaning of 3902 and the amount of coverage that needs to be offered goes against you.
Yes.
Maybe you can help me with that.
Well, the action was filed by plaintiff. The plaintiff put in the complaint that USAA agreed to reform the policy up to 100, 300. But he asked the court to grant him insurance of 300, 500. So when we filed our answer, we conceded that we did, in fact, agree to pay 100, 300, but that there was no basis in law to obtain insurance coverage in the amount of 300, 500. And we asked the court to dismiss the lawsuit.
But wait a second. If you agree that it should be reformed to 100, 300, doesn't that necessarily mean that you agreed that the proper offer had not been made initially, and therefore, what flowed from that, whether it's $100, $300, or $300, $500, the initial trigger has happened.
I like I said earlier, I don't know because we really haven't had the facts to develop it. But USAA, based upon Mason alone, because Mason said that this is not adequate to inform a policyholder that he is entitled to that additional coverage, we conceded that, okay, under Mason, we owe that additional coverage of $100, $300. We're talking, I think, an equitable action if you want to reform to get the $300, $500. This is where I'm talking about an equitable action. I think what the court is asking me is if we have conceded that we owe, that Mason hasn't been followed, don't we in fact concede that we have to pay $300, $500? If the court rules that we have to, then of course we do. But I don't think that that's, I'm not sure we're answering this question.
Well, I think Justice Berger and I were speaking at the same time to the same issue. It struck me, as apparently it strikes her, if I can be bold enough to suggest that, that this is an interlocutory appeal that we have. This case isn't settled on all of the potential issues and isn't right for us to decide. You're asking us to decide one legal issue in the case, but if we decided adversely to your position, you want a trial on the balance. Is that not correct?
I guess in a sense it is, although that's that wasn't the posture. The case was dismissed because we had conceded the $100, $300. The plaintiff asked for $300, $500. The court said no because of NAP, you can't get that. So the action was dismissed. So it wasn't, it's properly, I think, before the court.
It was a final judgment.
That was
that. So how are you going to undo that? If hypothetically, we wrote an opinion that said, you've conceded the point, and we think the answer is $300, $500, not $100, $300. How are you going to unconcede the point?
I don't think I can, Your Honor. Realistically, I don't think I can at that point. Maybe I misunderstood. I was thinking the question was, how can there be a reformation? And there can be under different facts in this case.
So the fact is going to stay established that there has to be reformation because there wasn't compliance with Mason.
That's correct.
And then if that fact stays constant, the legal issue is, if you're offering more, can you only now offer the statutory maximum, or do you have to offer what you had been offering in excess of that to mirror what was purchased as basic insurance?
Well, I think that is the issue. And I think you have to go back and again look at the statute. Because the statute does not give, I assume it does not give the court authority to do that. The statute says there's a cap.
Well, our collective concern, as you can see, is whether or not we've got a case in controversy here or we're deciding an academic question. But as I understand your answers now, it's not going to be academic because the point is not going to change. That notice consistent with Mason was not given. And therefore, the only issue are what are the legal consequences that flow from that.
I think I agree on that. I agree on that. I've always considered this to be the legal issue, not the factual issue. If the legal issue is to whether the reformation can be beyond $300,000 as set forth in the statute. And I submit the court just doesn't have the authority to do that because the statute, it says there's an ambiguity, and I submit there is no ambiguity. That when you read it, it doesn't say you have to offer mandatorily, that you have to offer UM the same as liability. It says you offer up to $100, $300, but no more than the basic policy. And I submit to the court that it could have been very easily for the legislature to have corrected that if they wanted to by simply saying you must offer UM the same amount as liability, and then that's the end of it. But that's basically what the plaintiff is arguing in this case, and that's what he wants the court to do, even though there has to be a basis for it, and there isn't any under this statute. And under none of the cases that the court has previously decided, and as I said, not just NAP, but also in the Kenner case, that issue came up, and the court has said the statute is clear. So I don't know where there is an ambiguity, and I submit to the court that should not create an ambiguity to give to change the statute. The statute is clear. If the legislature wants to change it, the legislature most certainly can.
Thank you.
Ms.
court is very busy, and I really have nothing else to add. Kenner was my case. I brought it before the Supreme Court, and the issue there was whether credit should be given for liability settlement against coverage or against damages. Kenner was reformed by an action in the Court of Chancery, or I'm sorry, Superior Court by Judge Babiar, sued $300,000. So I don't remember the issue Mr. Cancerino spoke of. And of course, Kenner was reversed by this court in the Hearst case. Mr. Simarco submitted an affidavit before the Superior Court. And in the affidavit, he said he was not advised of his coverage. USAA agreed to increase it based upon the fact that he wasn't informed to the 103. Mr. Cancerino and USAA were convinced that NAP would control. That's why the motion on the pleading was filed, and that's why the court did that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.